Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and today we're going out in the cold. I've got to say, when we started planning this show, we were kind of banking on more extreme weather right about now, more like last January when we got socked by all that snow toward month's end, or the January before, of course, when people were still going on and on about Snowmageddon, Snowpocalypse, what have you. Nevertheless, this week we still have some stories relating to actual cold, like a behind-the-scenes preview of a world premiere musical based on the classic children's book, The Snowy Day. But we'll also look at the changing face of No Child Left Behind, which lawmakers had hoped would keep students from being left out in the cold, so to speak. We'll hear how sex workers are being pushed to remote, often residential, parts of the city. And we'll learn about a shelter designed to keep homeless women out of the elements and why it's generating so much heat among the residents of one D.C. neighborhood. First, though, think about the last time you were cold. I mean, like teeth chattering, goosebump raising, shivering in your boots, cold. Now, I'm going to hazard a guess and say you were probably outside. And depending on where you were, the temperature very well could have been below zero. Washington, D.C.'s lowest recorded temperature is 15 degrees below zero. And in a slightly colder place, like, say, Alaska, it's more like 80 below. But if you take that last number, 80 degrees below zero, and you multiply it by 5, you'll get an idea of just how cold the James Webb Space Telescope will be after it's launched a million miles from Earth in the year 2018.
The whole thing in orbit will be below 40 Kelvin, which is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit below zero.
This is Ray Lundquist.
I'm systems engineer for the James Webb Space Telescope.
Lundquist works at Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. The James Webb Space Telescope is an international collaboration among NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Canadian Space Agency. Goddard is managing the project, named for the NASA administrator who played a crucial role in the Apollo program in the 1960s. Now, of course, we already have a space telescope, Hubble, which went into orbit in 1990. Webb is Hubble's successor and is 100 times more sensitive. As to why? Well, those frigid temperatures Lundquist mentions?
Below 40 Kelvin, which is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit below zero.
Play a huge part, and we'll explain all of that in just a moment. But first, hear that whooshing in the background? That's the sound of filtered air flowing through a very special facility at Goddard.
It's called the SysDIF, the Spacecraft Systems Development and Integration Facility.
And we're in the SysDIF's clean room, a vast, nearly contaminant-free chamber where people like Lundquist are testing and assembling parts of the Webb telescope. It's actually the same room where much of Hubble's work was done.
Yeah, we just actually kicked Hubble out of here last year, year before last, in order to get ready for this program.
As you enter the clean room, you have to step on this bright blue, dust-grabbing sticky mat. Oh, I want to get the sound of that sticky mat. Sound of shoes on the sticky mat there. But not just any shoes. Everyone in the clean room, myself included, is padding around in these half-length, elasticized white booties with matching jumpsuits and hoods. The whole getup, says optical engineer Theo Hadjimichael, is affectionately known in the biz as a bunny suit.
We're big white rabbits, gowned from head to toe in a white material that's very, very smooth. Doesn't allow anything to accumulate.
Because think about it, particles of schmutz on the Webb telescope would be like fingerprints on your camera lens, only so much worse.
In fact, the particles will distribute because there will be no atmosphere to contain them. So, a small fingerprint will spread across the optic and contaminate the surface.
Thereby ruining the images Webb's expected to beam back to Earth. And what glorious images they'll be, or so says Lee Feinberg, Webb's optical telescope element manager.
The most rewarding thing about working on a space telescope, and we had this experience when we fixed Hubble, is when those first images come down. People have been on this project for 10 years, 15 years, and we're all going to make it through to the finish line because we want to see those images.
It's like a sonogram almost, you know?
Exactly. You're seeing your baby for the first time.
And seeing our own history out there in the sky.
That's Webb's senior project scientist, the Nobel Prize-winning John Mather. I meet Mather and Feinberg in an observation area overlooking the clean room. And what Mather means by seeing our own history is this. Webb is so powerful that once it's up in space,
we can see the first objects that formed after the Big Bang, the first stars and galaxies. That's what we're planning to look for.
That blows my mind.
Well, it blows my mind, too. That's why I love this project.
It's got to take a lot to blow your mind, given what you deal with every day.
Yes, but this does it.
But wait, there's more. Something else Webb will be able to see are planets around other stars.
We can even see whether a planet could have water on the surface. So that's how we'll tell if there's a planet that could have life, because it would have water.
And that, my friends, that is where the whole cold thing comes in. You know.
Below 40 Kelvin, which is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit below zero.
See, the Webb telescope works by using mirrors to observe infrared light from distant objects. Infrared is heat radiation, and all warm things like the sun, the Earth, the moon, the telescope itself emit infrared light. But if you keep the telescope super cold, like, say,
below 40 Kelvin, which is about 400 degrees Fahrenheit below zero.
Okay, that's the last time you'll hear that, I promise. But the point is, if you keep the telescope super cold, then heat can't muddy up the images the telescope is collecting. John Mather says that's part of the problem with Hubble.
The Hubble telescope glows. It emits hundreds and thousands of watts of infrared power. And so it can't possibly be used to observe those same wavelengths where it's emitting bright light.
The Webb telescope, on the other hand, has this five-layered, tennis court-sized Kapton sun shield. Kapton is similar to a mylar, like in a balloon. And using the sun shield is like slathering yourself in SPF 1 million.
Let me add that after you get that, then you have such extraordinary sensitivity, we can see the heat that's emitted by a bumblebee at the distance of the moon.
Can you say that again? Did I hear that right?
We can see the heat that's emitted by a bumblebee at the distance of the moon.
And that, says Lee Feinberg, makes the James Webb Space Telescope revolutionary.
I have a lot of friends who remember the Apollo days, and they think back to these amazing things NASA did. And, you know, what we're doing, I think, on James Webb is our generation's version of Apollo. You know, we've been to the moon, but we haven't built a telescope that can see the early universe.
And Sherry says it's challenging, not to mention costly. Congress has approved $8 billion to launch Webb and several hundred million more to keep it up in space for the 5 years required for operation. But Feinberg is certain it's worth it.
It's part of discovery. You know, it's manifest destiny. There's just this great desire to understand, you know, what we can't see now and what we haven't been able to see.
Which is enough to warm anyone's heart, he says, even if it takes a whole lot of cold to do it. To learn more about the James Webb Space Telescope and to check out a webcam, get it? Webcam of Goddard's Clean Room, visit our website, metroconnection.org.
To the extreme, I rock a mic like a vandal. Light up a stage and wax a chump like a candle. Ice, ice, baby. Ice, ice, baby.
We head back to Earth now, to the streets of D.C., for a story that takes this week's Out in the Cold theme in a very different direction. D.C. has adopted some of the toughest anti-prostitution laws in the country. And the city council is weighing a measure that would make those laws even tougher. But as David Schultz reports, advocates for the district's sex workers say these laws only push prostitutes into the shadows and leave many out in the cold. And a warning to our listeners, some of the content in this story may not be appropriate for children.
It's just before midnight, and three people, all in their late teens or early 20s, are loading a Honda minivan with supplies.
Do we have hot chocolate?
This might sound like the beginning of a zany road trip, but it definitely is not. The minivan belongs to a group called HIPS, which stands for Helping Individual Prostitutes Survive. And those supplies getting loaded into the van?
We have our giant box of condoms. Several different kinds, Magnums, Lifestyle, XO, etc.
That's Josh Engel, a 19-year-old HIPS volunteer. The mission of HIPS is to make the lives of D.C.'s prostitutes safer and easier. So, three nights a week, HIPS staffers and volunteers drive this van to places where sex workers work, often some of the most dangerous parts of town. Jenna Miller is tonight's team leader.
Hey! Do you want any condoms or candy or water?
She says the trick to doing this kind of work is to be positive, but not too positive.
We meet people where they're at. If someone is sad, we will sit in that sad moment with them. If someone's frustrated, we would never say something like, oh, like, it's okay, don't worry, like some, like, trite, positive statement. What we want to do is add.
To maintain its clients' confidentiality, HIPS asked us not to record these encounters. But there were a few people, a few sex workers in fact, who said they wanted to talk on the record. One was a transgendered woman who goes by the name Uzi.
Like the Uzi off the gun, y'all.
Uzi works downtown in an area where many transgendered women operate. She says life as a prostitute, working on the streets, isn't actually that crazy.
No, my day-to-day life is actually the same as everyone else. I get up in the morning, I read, I'm into mysteries, I love CSI, Law & Order, and my favorite show is House.
But Uzi has no illusions about her job. She knows it's unsafe. She says robberies are common, and her johns, or dates as she calls them, can sometimes be abusive. But Uzi says what makes her job really difficult, more than any of that, is the police.
We are more of a target from the police than the dates. We are more worried about the police harassing us than the dates are. You know what I'm saying? Because the police come out here and they lock us up. Like 13 of us are locked up now. Because they want to send undercovers out here, you know, to bust us and everything. But what's the point of that? Because as soon as we get right back out, we're going to be doing it again.
The police are within their rights to target Uzi and her colleagues, of course. Prostitution is illegal. But Kelly Bright, another transgendered woman who also works downtown, says the police only seem interested in arresting prostitutes, not protecting them.
Y'all come out here and tell us to be safe and all that and all that. Okay, thank you and all that. But the question is, when we call y'all, y'all never there.
We contacted the police department spokeswoman multiple times for a response, but she wouldn't grant us an interview. Bright is trying to get out of the prostitution business, but she says with so few places willing to hire a transgendered person, sex work is the only way she can pay her bills.
I'm doing some stuff now to try to get my little life and stuff together and everything, but you know, I'm doing that because I finally realized I'm tired.
People who live in this area who have no other access to economic means, you know, will do sex work because it's sometimes the thing of last resort.
Cindy Clay is the executive director of HIPS. She says there's a reason why Uzi, Kelly, and the other sex workers who operate downtown have been feeling pressure from the police. The D.C. Council passed a law 5 years ago designed to crack down on parts of the city known to be prostitution hotspots. The law allows the police department to designate certain streets prostitution-free zones. In these zones, officers have the power to make arrests with a lower burden of proof. So far, most of the prostitution-free zones have been located in the downtown urban core of the district. And Clay says that's had some surprising effects. She says she first noticed them when HIPS had to change the route of its nightly outreach missions.
Since the institution of the free zones, we're having to travel a much wider circle around the city. We can't reach all of the neighborhoods that we're trying to reach in one night. We're traveling upwards of 50 miles an evening just to kind of reach all the populations that we need to reach, and we're in much more residential neighborhoods.
Clay says the prostitution free zone law hasn't eliminated or reduced prostitution in the district. The law simply moved it from downtown to the outskirts of the city. And based on a WAMU analysis of D.C. crime data, Clay is right. Over the past decade, the share of arrests that took place in Ward 2 went down by 10%. That's the ward that contains most of downtown. Meanwhile, in Ward 7, east of the Anacostia River, the share of prostitution arrests has more than tripled.
We now have prostitution running rampant east of the river.
D.C. Councilmember Yvette Alexander represents Ward 7. Prostitution running rampant is the kind of thing that makes business owners and homeowners get their council member on the phone and give her an earful. So Alexander is introducing an amendment that would make the prostitution-free zone law even stronger. Right now, the zones can last no longer than 10 days. Alexander's amendment would allow them to go on indefinitely. Alexander says now prostitutes can just wait out a zone. Under her amendment,
they're going to have to leave the area completely. So, you know, we're thinking either you make a decision if, you know, they're going to be these prostitution-free zones, then that's my cue that I need to get out of the prostitution business.
Several other cities have their own version of prostitution-free zones, but it's unclear if any city has ever tried making them permanent. At-large Councilman Phil Mendelson says he's worried the amendment won't hold up in court.
The Supreme Court has consistently held that anti-loitering statutes are unconstitutional. Then in America, people have a right to stand on the corner if they want to, for whatever reason.
Mendelson isn't opposed to temporary prostitution-free zones. He says they can be effective tools for high-crime areas as long as the people arrested are offered treatment and not just shuffled through the legal system. But according to data from local prosecutors, that's exactly what's been happening. More than 90% of all prostitution-related arrests last year led to formal charges being filed with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Cindy Clay, the executive director of HIPS, says the free zone law has been full of unintended consequences.
It just comes down to the fact that this is just bad public health. It's bad public health. It's bad social policy. It's not even effective judicial policy because we're not giving people the tools that they need to change their life or to make a change. We're just reincarcerating the same people over and over again for the same thing.
It's just after 5 in the morning, and the HIPS minivan has left downtown. It's now driving through a notoriously violent neighborhood in Northeast D.C. Jenna Miller, the HIPS team leader, says this is where many sex workers have come to avoid getting caught in a free zone.
And as you can see, it has less markers of safety, which is street lights, which is police, which is people on the streets who can be your eyes and ears for if something happens.
The tone here is much different than in downtown. Hardly anyone stays and talks with the HIPS team. They mostly just take their brown paper bags full of supplies and leave. They look visibly afraid. HIPS keeps track of every sex worker it encounters, and it says there's roughly the same number on the streets now as there was a decade ago. It's just now they're more likely to get a criminal record and more likely to be working in a violent area. They're more isolated and more at risk, but they're less visible. I'm David Schultz.
To see the data about the shifting nature of prostitution in the district and to see where your ward fits into the picture, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Time now for a quick break, but when we get back, building bridges, literally and metaphorically, between D.C. neighborhoods.
You know, I sort of think about this bridge as a neighborhood street that happens to cross a river.
That and more coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU news coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for our news coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today, we are heading out in the cold. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk about shelter and why plans for one particular shelter in Anacostia have some residents up in arms. And speaking of Anacostia, if you commute that way by car, you've no doubt seen a whole lot of construction around there. It's the building of the new 11th Street Bridge, D.C.'s biggest infrastructure project in decades. And that new bridge is actually three bridges, all constructed in between the two spans of the old bridge. This past Saturday, the city opened another portion of the bridge to traffic headed east across the Anacostia River. And that is the topic of our regular transportation segment from A to B. Jonathan Wilson wanted to find out what comes next and what kind of an impact the District Department of Transportation hopes the new bridge will have. So he headed out to the middle of all that construction with DDOT's John Lyle.
We're standing on the new outbound freeway bridge, and right next to us on that side is the new inbound freeway bridge that opened in December. This bridge just opened last weekend.
In terms of the size of the project, I think this is pretty unprecedented, at least in recent years, for the district. Can you talk about how this compares, and how big of a deal this is for the city?
You know, we're about to come up on our 10-year anniversary as an independent agency at DDOT, and certainly during that decade, this is the largest project we've ever done. $300 million in the phase one of the project. There'll be some additional work in a second phase. So it's the largest project, infrastructure project we've ever done at DDOT. It's also the first complete river bridge replacement in approximately 40 years in the district. So it's a huge project. It's something that needed to be done because the existing bridges, the two existing bridges, have really outlived their useful life, and they need to be replaced. And we're going to replace them with three completely new bridges, two freeway bridges and one local bridge for local traffic. There are going to be, when this project is done, there are going to be ramps that will take you from the outbound bridge to northbound DC 295, also from southbound 295 to the inbound bridge. And those are movements that you just cannot make today. And so that's going to be a huge improvement. A lot of that traffic that uses the neighborhoods to make those movements now is going to be taken out of the neighborhoods. And so we think it's going to be a big improvement for commuters and for residents.
Obviously, a lot of people, and I know the local bridge is not quite finished yet, but a lot of people think that this is going to be a transformative project for the Anacostia region and connecting it to downtown.
Well, I'll tell you what, for us, this is one piece of the Anacostia Waterfront Initiative, which is there are a number of projects, that not just within DDOT, but at DDOT, this project is one of them. The replacement of the Frederick Douglass Bridge, the planned replacement over the next few years, is another one. And the Anacostia Riverwalk Trail, which is under construction now, about 20 miles of trail in the district on both sides of the river. So what we're doing is part of a larger plan within the district to really draw people back to the river, clean up the river, promote economic development along the river, and to make this a place that people want to live, work, play. You know, the bridges, the infrastructure projects are just a piece of that.
It feels like the District Department of Transportation is, it really sees itself as a catalyst. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it's fair to say, and I think one of the things that we're trying to do now that may not have been done in the past when these types of bridges were built. I mean, if you look at the sidewalk on the old bridge, I mean, it's not very wide, and it was not intended for a lot of heavy pedestrian bike traffic. What we're trying to do with these projects these days is to include those types of things that can be used by people who aren't driving. So the new local bridge is not only going to carry local traffic vehicles across the bridge in both directions, but it's also going to include a shared use path for bicyclists and pedestrians. It's also going to have, it's going to be streetcar ready so that we could add future transit if we decide to. So it's going to be used for transportation in a lot more ways than just driving.
Let's talk about that local bridge a little bit more. So right now, we're looking kind of down on it. How does the local bridge differ from, you know, the highway bridge? And talk a little bit more about those extra features in terms of trying to encourage different types of transit.
You know, I sort of think about this bridge as kind of just a neighborhood street that happens to cross a river, because right now all the traffic that goes to and from Anacostia goes across these freeway bridges. But instead, you're going to have this local bridge is really going to be a street that connects Anacostia with Capitol Hill and other neighborhoods on both sides of the river. And right now, you know, people aren't seeing the benefits of that bridge yet, but when it's completed, I think it's going to be transformative for the people who live on both sides of the river.
That was John Lyle of the D.C. Department of Transportation talking with WAMU's Jonathan Wilson. Do you have a transportation story you'd like us to cover on the show? Just zip us a note to metro@wamu.org. So as John Lyle was suggesting, city officials are hoping the 11th Street Bridge will make it easier to get right from downtown D.C. to the heart of historic Anacostia. And that's an area that's in the midst of a slow but sure economic revitalization. After decades of blight, signs of reinvestment are popping up all over. Banks, a bustling coffee shop, an art gallery. But many neighbors fear all that could be at risk because of one more recent development in the commercial corridor. A transitional home for women. The local nonprofit Calvary Women's Services is building the shelter, and community members have been protesting it for more than 6 months. As Emily Friedman tells us, construction has begun, but the community is not backing down.
The reason many residents are upset has nothing to do with what Calvary does. There are more than 6,500 homeless people in the district, and not even half that many shelter beds. The issue many Anacostians have with Calvary is not its mission, but its location. Greta Fuller, one of Historic Anacostia's ANC commissioners, takes me on a driving tour to explain just how many social services there are in her neighborhood.
If you look directly across the street, you'll see Bread for the City. And if you also look right next door to Bread for the City, you'll see Good Hope Road Youth Center. So we're by no means lacking social services and programs in our community. You see, we're approaching Minnesota Avenue. We have the methadone clinic. It's Good Hope Institute right here to your right.
We continue down Good Hope Road, and there's an employment agency and a program for ex-offenders. Within a 5-block radius, there are at least 20 social service agencies. Then we arrive at a corner where the buildings suddenly look brighter, newer.
There's a bike share. We have the Hive where we have entrepreneurs.
This is the heart of Anacostia's business district and the site of Calvary's shelter.
Where this shelter is going to be placed is really the main place in our community that's going to spur revitalization and growth for Anacostia.
News that the shelter's coming, she says, has already cut into prospects.
I actually had one guy who wanted to come over here and bring a tapas bar, and he's deciding against it now since the shelter's coming. He said that he didn't think that a tapas bar would survive.
Fuller says she wants to see something residents like her can actually use.
Ideally, I'd like to see a bakery. I'd like to see FedEx. I'd like to honestly see something as simple as a pharmacy.
Calvary's executive director, Chris Thompson, declined to be interviewed for this story. But at a community meeting last week, she took the podium in front of nearly 100 concerned citizens, some holding cardboard signs that read, "No beds in the business corridor." Thompson insisted it's not an emergency shelter where people line up to be let inside. The building, she says, will operate much like an apartment building.
Calvary is excited to be moving to this neighborhood. We'll be investing about $3 million in this community and want to be a part of the revitalization that we see is already underway here.
Calvary bought the building a little more than a year ago. It's relocating from Chinatown, where the organization has operated since its founding in the early 80s. Thompson says transitional housing doesn't mean a commercial center can't flourish.
We've been in the Gallery Place Chinatown neighborhood during its redevelopment over the last 25 years. And have been good neighbors in that neighborhood and have seen tremendous changes. And it's our hope and our commitment that that would happen in this neighborhood as well.
Greta Fuller was also at the meeting, and she came out in stark disagreement. She says Anacostia has become a dumping ground for food pantries, drug rehab facilities, and group homes. People come from all over the city, she says, to use these services. And that's not the sort of traffic Anacostians want.
$300 million was spent on the 11th Street Bridge, was supposed to revitalize and bring our community into the rest of the District of Columbia. And what we have at the foot of that bridge is a transitional housing.
Ward 8 Council Member Marion Barry addresses the crowd next and says, since Calvary is not in violation of zoning, it's best to look at the upside.
This is not a shelter. This is a transition house for 50 ladies, many of whom have been battered and beaten, domestic violence, drugs. So let's get that straight very quickly.
While Barry's talking, one protester walks to the front of the crowd with a poster. It says, "Mr. Barry, we need your help."
Okay, we're going to open up the floor for questions.
There are a lot of questions for Chris Thompson, and all of her answers are short. One proposed solution is that Calvary rent out the first floor as retail space and have the shelter on the upper floors. Thompson does not indicate whether that's possible or not.
Let's just talk real here. Let's just stop the tomfoolery.
This is Nikki Peel. She's a resident of Ward 8 and also writes a blog called Congress Heights on the Rise.
Number one, you're not here because you want to be here. You're here because you're ashamed to be here. Because people just like me stood up all night long writing articles, Twittering and Facebooking saying, be a good neighbor and come talk to us. We work hard every day so that this community could step up, so we could have places to eat and places to shop and places to live. We want this community to do better. And you just ignored us.
While Calvary continues constructing apartments for homeless women, many neighbors, like Nikki Peel, say it's the community that's being left out in the cold. I'm Emily Friedman.
For nearly a decade, the D.C. public schools have been somewhat out in the cold when it comes to meeting federal educational standards, specifically No Child Left Behind. Under that law, students are supposed to be 100% proficient in reading and math by 2014. But many schools aren't meeting those targets, so the Obama administration is offering waivers, which it says will allow districts to continue to make improvements while moving away from what it calls too much emphasis on a single standardized test on a single day. Now, D.C. is joining about 40 states that have either applied or said they will apply for the waiver. Education reporter Kavitha Cardoza has more on what this means for the city's schools and students.
Kayleen Irizarry is the Assistant Superintendent of Elementary and Secondary Education for all D.C.'s public schools, both traditional and charter. She says she supports many aspects of No Child Left Behind.
Looking at accountability in a systemic way, looking at how separate groups are performing, whether it's by ethnicity or race or gender, and then holding schools accountable, holding school districts accountable for how we support our schools to show that student learning is taking place.
But she echoes the Obama administration's call to move beyond what it calls bubble tests and dumbed-down standards. She says the problem with the law is it only focuses on whether a school has made the target or not, and the bar is continually being raised.
It applied a standard that was uniform to all schools and didn't take into account the uniqueness of each of the schools or other contributions that are taking place at the school that get at how a school is performing, such as how many of our students are taking advanced courses, how many of our teachers are rated highly effective, what is our truancy rate.
Irizarry says an overwhelming number of schools in D.C. are in some form of mandatory improvement. Last year, approximately 70 to 74% of elementary and high school students were supposed to hit reading and math targets.
Out of the 187 schools that were assessed under the D.C. CAS, only 25 of those schools made adequate yearly progress in both subjects.
But she says if D.C. is allowed to opt out of certain provisions of No Child Left Behind, it'll allow schools to measure effectiveness beyond just two or three benchmarks. The district has already begun implementing what's called the Common Core Curriculum, rigorous expectations for what students should learn every year from kindergarten through high school. Approximately 40 states will follow the same standards, which were created to get students ready for college or a career when they graduated. Irizarry says D.C.'s application will also look at other measures, such as how many students are ready for kindergarten, how many take remedial college courses, and how many take the SATs.
We're looking at, are students attending school? Are they returning to the same school? And on the special populations section, we want to look at how our English language learners learning English. Are they on track to learn that? And for special education, we're looking to see how many of those special education students take the DC CAS versus the alternative assessment.
Critics have said allowing states to pursue different targets will create a jumble, making it impossible to compare them. And the Alliance for Excellent Education, an advocacy group, says some states give too little weight to certain measures, such as whether students are graduating. For example, in Kentucky and New Mexico, graduation rates only count for approximately 15% of the accountability system. D.C.'s waiver application isn't yet complete, but Irizarry says moving away from No Child Left Behind as it's written now is good for D.C.
As a former teacher and school district administrator, it can be disheartening when you show so much progress and you've made such significant gains despite the circumstances, and you don't get credit for that because there's a target that has to be met and nothing else is considered.
DC's application is due February 21st, and once it's done, school officials will spend the rest of the winter months hoping the request is approved. Final word is expected back from the Obama administration by the summer. I'm Kavitha Cardoza.
What's your opinion? Is DC's pursuit of a No Child Left Behind waiver a good move? You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/metroconnection.org or send an email to metro@wamu.org. After the break, a bittersweet reunion as members of the military come home from war.
When I left, he was a toddler, and when came back, he was a boy.
It's just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and this week we're going out in the cold. And sure, when it comes to cold and snow especially, things around the Washington region have been relatively gentle of late. But at Adventure Theater, the longest-running children's theater in the D.C. area, one thing is certain. The snow is about to fall. Big time. And when it does, it'll be accompanied.
So this is how Peter, so he's feeling the snow, seeing the snow.
By music.
He gets very excited about it.
And producing artistic director Michael Bobbitt is getting very excited, too, because Adventure Theater is gearing up to present a world premiere musical based on Ezra Jack Keats' classic picture book, The Snowy Day. Bobbitt recently invited some friends of the theater to a rehearsal, where he previewed the orchestral tracks for some of the songs, like this one, Peter's First Steps.
Makes you happy, doesn't it?
The Snowy Day tells the story of Peter, a young boy who awakens one morning to the season's first snowfall. And it turns out the story, which Keats wrote in 1962, was pretty revolutionary for its time, because little Peter in his bright red snowsuit was the first African-American character to star in a full-color picture book. In fact, Keats, who was white and Jewish, once said of his protagonist, "My book would have him there simply because he should have been there all along." Do you have any reaction to that quote?
Well, I'm African-American. My son is Vietnamese. My partner is Caucasian. And so diversity is a big part of who I am. And it's strange to believe that less than 50 years ago, we were so segregated. So yes, Peter should have always been there, and he can experience the snow for the first time just like anyone else.
This production is the second in Adventure Theater's African American Adventure series, 5 world premiere musicals based on books about the African American experience. The first musical was Mirandy and Brother Wind, adapted from a 1997 children's story.
I was looking for an African American story to launch this series, and all of the stories that I read were based on historical characters. But I wanted to find things that really celebrated the culture and didn't necessarily talk about race. So I set out to find books that did just that.
And The Snowy Day, Bobbitt says, was always a personal favorite.
I can see the copy of my book when I was a kid that was just wrinkled and tattered and torn because I read it so many times.
Bobbitt says all the musicals in the African American Adventure series are composed by African American artists. He enlisted D.C. area playwright and actor David Emerson Toney to write The Snowy Day's script. For music and lyrics, he turned to Darius Smith, a Howard University musical theater professor who let me in on a little secret. Darius said when he was little, he didn't read The Snowy Day.
Oh, shame on him. Shame on him.
But I love it now.
And how could he not? Smith says when Michael Bobbitt gave him the book,
I read it over and over again and then had some conversations with my collaborator, David Toney. And we kind of just dove into the world of this late 60s, 70s type inspiration.
You can hear that inspiration in a number of Smith's songs, including one the cast ran through at that invited rehearsal. It's called Walk This Way.
Walk this way.
That's Calvin McCullough in the role of Harold the Snowman. Now, Ezra Jack Keats does mention in his book that Peter made a smiling snowman. But in David Toney's script, that snowman becomes Harold, who's desperate to get to the North Pole. Harold is among several characters added by Toney, and Darius Smith applauds his collaborator's creative license.
Kind of like how I was inspired for the music, he was inspired by the stories and just created all these wonderful characters that are really fleshed out and have their own journeys. It's great just seeing the book, which is so simple in its beauty, kind of blown up and into this whole new world of things.
But of course, this new world also includes original, iconic elements from Keats's book, says Alan Wiggins, who plays Peter.
So you will see Peter and the footprints. You'll see the mound of snow fall on Peter's head. Harold the snowman gives me the snowball that I try to save for the next day. So you're going to get everything that you want and love from the book and then so much more.
And you're going to get it, Wiggins says, no matter who you are. Because even though 50 years ago the idea of a white Jewish man telling an African-American child's story did raise some eyebrows, Wiggins says, really? It's a moot point.
It is not a story about the struggles of this African-American child. It's a child who is African-American going through normal, everyday things that any six-year-old would go through. He's experiencing new things. He's using his imagination. And the story is universal.
Perhaps not 100% universal in these parts, given that our region's six-year-olds have yet to be treated to their first big snow of the season. But if, like Peter, you can reach into your mind and use that imagination, any day can be a snowy day. Any day at all. The Snowy Day opens January 20th at Adventure Theater in Glen Echo Park. For more on the show, visit our website, metroconnection.org. There's a particular warmth many troops deployed overseas often long for months or years at a time. The warmth of family. But coming home to one's family brings its own challenges as you reunite with spouses and children who have developed new routines without you. As waves of service members return from Iraq, Jessica Gould speaks with a Marine and his family about strategies for overcoming the challenges of homecoming.
As it is for any family, dinner with the Pates is a carefully choreographed dance. Everyone has a role. Elizabeth Pate and her son Jonah make the salad.
So some more, I think?
A little wet.
Brian Pate and his daughter Caroline set the table.
You get your placemat, sweetie?
But there was a time when this culinary corps was missing a member. In 2009, Brian, a major with the Marines, deployed to Iraq. He spent 15 months away from his family. Caroline wasn't born yet, and Jonah was just a toddler.
Every night we were watching the border of Syria looking for smugglers coming over. So, you know, you're very focused on ensuring that you can do that job and do it safely and get your guys back home. But in the back of your mind, yeah, you're always thinking about your family.
Brian wasn't just thinking about his family. He talked about Jonah all the time.
One thing I did a lot was show the picture of my son to the different sheikhs and mukhtars and Iraqi officials that I was meeting with. It was helpful because his name is Jonah, which is a biblical name, and translates into Arabic as Yunus, and which is a fairly common name over there. And so by the end of it, they were calling me Abu Yunus, father of Jonah.
So coming home to Jonah was one of the happiest moments of Brian's life.
It was awesome. It was a great feeling. You know, he asked, like, are you staying? And he'd say yes.
But Brian, who set the schedule for an entire unit overseas, didn't know the routine back at home.
What is it like to get up in the morning and get dressed and go to the learning group? So it really is like mundane, domestic kind of things that you're kind of observing to see how they go and figuring out what role to play.
He even had to tweak the way he talked.
You have to transition from dealing with 20-year-old Marines to being able to speak to a 3-year-old, and it's a very different mode of communications, and it takes some time to snap out of that.
Anita Chandra, a researcher with the RAND Corporation, has studied the effects of deployment on military families, and she says reintegration can be an especially complicated time for service members and their loved ones.
Well, the reintegration is a joyous period, and everybody's happy to have that service member parent home. It can be a struggle to reestablish routines, particularly if those home routines have changed in the absence of the service member.
Because of these challenges, the Department of Defense has developed programs to help service members reconnect with their families, and many nonprofits are also pitching in. Dorinda Williams is a social worker with the children's advocacy group 0 to 3. A few years ago, she wrote a picture book to help the children of service members prepare for their return.
Hooray, hooray, it's time to play with your special someone who's been away. Can you show them your toy, sing songs, hold their hand? If you're not feeling ready, then they'll understand. You can just take your time with this person who has come home at last and really loves you.
William says the goal of her book, Home Again, is to encourage families to be flexible with their expectations.
You've had a lot of months to think about this event. And I'm sure, you know, it becomes perfect in your head, that wonderful reunion where your child, for example, is going to come running into your arms.
But sometimes the child runs away from you instead.
That child's response is perfectly normal given the circumstances, and it's not a reflection on their relationship. And it's not indicative of how they're going to be able to reconnect.
That's why William says it's best to keep an open mind and keep talking. So every night, as they sit down to dinner, the Pates say how grateful they are.
Say grace, guys.
Thank you for letting me read.
Oh, man. Amen.
And they celebrate their time together.
Cheers.
I'm Jessica Gould.
If you or a spouse has served overseas in the military, what was your reintegration process like? We want to hear your story and your strategies for readjusting to civilian life. You can reach us at metro@wamu.org. And now, our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit the D.C. neighborhoods of Burleith and Tacoma Park.
My name's Rich Field. I live in Burleith in Washington, D.C. It's located approximately between Reservoir Road and Teeth Street and 37th and 39th Streets Northwest in Washington. It's about 500 homes. They're essentially row houses. If you first look at them, you think all the houses are the same. But actually, if you look a little closer, you'll see that they've all been changed quite a bit over the years, over almost 100 years. The renovations, internal and external, have really made them look different. So when someone comes to visit you, they usually come to the right house now. What attracted me to Burleith was the size of the community. It wasn't too big, it wasn't too small, it was just right.
My name is Virginia View, and I have lived in Tacoma Park on the same street since 1969. Tacoma, D.C. would be the northwest corner of the city from Van Buren, Georgia Avenue, and Eastern Avenue. We're a couple blocks from the metro. I can walk to two different post offices. I can walk to the Safeway. I can walk to two different CVS bank if I want to. We wanted a neighborhood that had more people of color. So we wanted a more integrated neighborhood, if you will. So it was a conscious decision to move here to Tacoma. We had heard about its reputation as an activist community and a community where people organized around issues that we were concerned about. We moved here right after the riots. Over the course of a couple of years, we saw a shift in terms of more African Americans moving in, but that changed very quickly. And I would say now it's almost about like it was. We moved here in terms of the racial makeup.
We heard from Virginia View in Tacoma Park and Rich Field in Burleith. Your neighborhood can be a part of Door to Door, too. Just send an email to metro@wamu.org or visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. And to see a map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Kavitha Cardoza, Emily Friedman, Jessica Gould, and Jonathan Wilson, along with reporter David Schultz. Jim Ascendio is our news director. Our managing producer is Tara Boyle. Jonna McCone, Lauren Landau, Peter Domingos, and Heather Taylor produce Door to Door. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can see a list of all the music we use on our website, metroconnection.org. Just click on an individual story, and you'll find information about its accompanying song. And while you're poking around metroconnection.org, you also can join us on Twitter and Facebook. You can read free transcripts of stories. And if you missed any part of today's show or want to listen to any of our recent shows, you can click the podcast link up at the top of the page. We hope you can join us next week when we bring you a show all about the burbs. We'll go back in time to D.C.'s original streetcar suburbs, and we'll consider just how far you can go outside the district and still be considered part of the Washington region. Plus, could the increasingly popular bike share program work in a more remote suburb?
I know from watching the cycling program in Washington just explode. So I don't know why it wouldn't work here.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.